American Log Homes and Cabins is assisting a developer in liquidating several of our kits that have deposits on them for only the balance owed. Most of these will save you more than half of the original cost. An example, our Augusta model, normally $42,450, is being sold for $16,500. Our Biloxi model, normally $36,825, is being sold for $14,500. This includes delivery, excluding California, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, Idaho, Alaska, and Hawaii, but we will pay partial shipping to those states. These kits have not been manufactured, and there's no time limit on delivery. This is a log home kit that includes complete blueprints from foundation details to roof, stack sheets, and a construction manual. Any do-it-yourselfer or builder can erect the logs. Kits do not include any part of roof, windows, or doors. Please call 704-602-3035 for availability. You can also visit our website at www.AmericanLogHomesAndCabins.com.
Movies and Booze, I'm Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.
You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk. 087-1400-106 is our WhatsApp number. Our email address is afternoon@newstalk.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. And just to remind you, our next outside broadcast is in the Sugar Club this day week. It's a special one. It's a weird mash together Frankenstein-like experiment where we have So You Think You're an Adult and Movies and Booze. Barbara and Declan will be there along with our usual Movies and Booze panel. You can try and register for tickets. I don't know what the situation is now. They're probably all gone, to be honest with you. But you can go to newstalk.com/events and have a go. Get yourself onto the waiting list, at least. And that's all with thanks to our friends in Marks and Spencer. As I did mention earlier on, there has been a very serious crash on the M50. So Dean McGuinness isn't with us yet. Serena Bellissimo and Brian Lloyd are. Good afternoon to you both. Serena, you had to abandon the car, did you?
I'm as red as this microphone. I abandoned it in Rathmines and just ran down. And if you're coming down, you know, Camden Street that turns into Georgia Street, that turns into that street, that long street there, that's a car park. So if you're coming from down there, don't even think I'll catch a bus or get a taxi. Literally just get off and just walk. You'll be quicker.
Right. Smug cyclist over here. I cycled in from Drumcondra. So.
That's the spirit, yeah. It's extraordinary that it'd have that much of a knock-on effect from the M50.
Well, I left home and I was like, oh, I'll be there in plenty of time, 10 to 3. I text Brian. I was just like, every minute it kept adding on 10 minutes, And I was just like, okay, we're getting off.
Crikey. Yeah. So that is, yeah, if you are sitting in town and you're stuck in your car and you're giving out yards about this, just do remember there's been a very serious accident on the M50, and that obviously has a bit of a human toll to it. So the two movies we're doing today, Brian, Ransom 79, Charlie Bird, but nothing to do with Charlie Bird and his illness. This is Charlie Bird, like, still doing a story.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say it's 50-50 on that. So essentially what's going on is Charlie Bird is essentially investigating what he knows will be his final story. And it's this incredible... I never heard of this. But apparently there was this massive extortion plot that happened between 1979 and 1980 where this group of criminals essentially tried to extort £5 million from the Irish government. And Ray McSherry and Special Branch and the Fraud Squad were all involved in it. And Charlie Bird basically is trying to investigate and find out the identities of the gang. But while he's doing this, of course, he is obviously... his health is deteriorating from motor neuron disease. But it's not necessarily about that so much as it's about, I guess it's the fact that, like, even with this debilitating disease, his mind was still incredibly sharp. He was still on the hunt, like, he was still working as much as he could. And he talks about how, you know, even though this disease is robbing him of his speech and he uses, like, the AI voice bank and everything, that he still wants to do it because this is all he knows how to do. This is the only way that keeps him alive, you know?
Yeah, right. And is this a Disney movie?
You would think that, wouldn't you? No, it's from the imaginary mind of John Krasinski, and which is a little bit kind of like, really, John, you're only in your third film, the two of them were sequels? Like, you know, who do you think you are here? Like, sling your hook there, pal, yeah? But anyways, so John Krasinski essentially directs this live-action animated hybrid where he is a father of a young girl who is able to see imaginary friends. They're voiced by a whole cavalcade of famous people. You have Steve Carell, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Jon Stewart, George Clooney, Sam Rockwell, Amy Schumer, Emily Blunt, Blake Lively, loads and loads of famous people voice all these imaginary friends. And her and Ryan Reynolds, Casey Fleming, sorry, the young daughter of John Krasinski's character, are trying to reunite all these imaginary friends with their now grown adults.
Right. Okay.
Can I ask a question? Because we watched this film and at the end, I'm not giving anything away, but you know the guy in the stall. Is that Kieran Culkin?
I think so, actually. Now that you say
it. I kept turning to my husband going, That's Kieran Culkin. He's like, oh, I don't think so. It's just that he's got this big beard on and you see him twice.
Yeah, it could be because, like, I mean, I don't think they credited half the people there, like, so.
And he's not credited because I went and did a deep dive and couldn't find him anywhere.
Might have been. I don't know, yeah. Because, like, I mean, I remember reading the wiki afterwards, like, and they didn't have half the names of the people that were there, like, and I remember, like, I know that voice. That was definitely Vince Vaughn or something like that. And then, of course, somebody added it in. Could be, I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, how come he managed to attract so many people?
Because
to
he's John Krasinski and he's married Emily Blunt and he's just like called in every favour he had and probably gave out a few. And like plus as well, for famous people as well, like it's literally you just go into a voice booth and just say like 5-10 lines, you're handed a piece of paper, you don't have to memorise script, and then you can walk out and you're done and then
that's
you collect a few little pop for it, you know?
Yeah.
And he's one of the nicest guys in Hollywood and a lot of these actors are looking for films that they can bring their families to. So this is something that their families can come to too. And then when they go to the premieres, they're having the big parties and seeing each other and stuff. It's like win-win.
And the kids are going, oh, daddy's in this film and mummy's in the film and all that stuff. Now we're doing traffic bulletins. It's taken 1.5 hours to go from Clane to Maynooth. Everyone using
Clane.
This route. Yes.
Clane mentioned, sorry.
3 hours so far in Park West Dublin 12 to Navan, usually 50 minutes. Poor person involved in an accident in the M50 though, says Jonathan. Who is on the N3? God love you. Right, so you're so smug on your bicycle.
No, I wonder, I'm sorry. If
Eamon Gilmore had his way, there would be like bicycle traffic jams.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because people would be kicking each other.
Yeah. You know, Eamon
Gilmore, sorry. Happy Gilmore. That's why I put it in my head. They're going to make a sequel to Happy Gilmore. Why? And who wants one? Is this just because Adam Sandler has, you know.
He's got a massive deal with Netflix.
And he's running out of ideas.
And it seems to be that anything he touches does turn to gold. And Happy Gilmore was released in 1996.
Yeah, that's right.
Like
and it's still funny.
It is, and it's one of his funnier films. Although I like the one, is it The Waterboy, where he's the football?
Yeah,
that's The Waterboy,
I don't need a sequel to that if you're listening, Adam. Happy Gilmore's enough. But Netflix, all the upfronts seem to be happening now. If you don't know what upfront is, that's when the big media companies go and they give their presentations to sponsors and advertising agencies to go, look, this is what we've got coming, give us all your money. And so it was announced there. That he's definitely going to do a sequel. But it was announced earlier, his co-star, Christopher McDonald, who plays his nemesis, Shooter McGavin, he was speaking on a podcast and he sort of said that Adam had already given him a script and he thought it looks really good and he really wants to be a part of it. And then it was officially announced. But it just seems to be like Hollywood is really drying up. Like, because everything seems to be remakes, sequels, and so, although we can't say superhero movies because there hasn't been one in a long time.
No,
goodness.
Well, at least there's that. But you'd wonder what it's like when they're doing these upfronts and you have these salespeople going, and we're making a remake of that and a prequel to this and, you know, this other movie with a hat on. Like, how do advertisers even get turned on by that?
Well, I think they get turned on because the people they're talking to are probably the people from that generation who loved these films when they first came out. Because we're not talking about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
We're talking about 30 years ago. So the people who are now making decisions are going back going, I want to relive my youth. And so we're getting everything that they loved in their youth and hoping that the youth are actually going to enjoy what's coming out.
But on top of that as well is the fact that they know that Happy Gilmore was a massive hit.
Yeah.
They're so kind of adverse to, you know, anything potentially unique or original. They just want a surefire hit. And something even out of curiosity, people would watch Happy Gilmore too. Mm. I mean, I love the original, so like I would watch this purely out of, you know, sort of morbid curiosity than anything else.
And it'll be on Netflix, so you can watch it in 2.5 speed if you need to.
I just watched the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
and then abandon it. Yeah. And so have they given any indication what happens? It's Happy Gilmore, obviously, is going to be a lot older.
No, just know that it's going
to
be awesome.
They don't need to.
People will be tuned in.
Even more, and Like, because the showbiz lot now is just remakes and prequels.
Yeah.
But this is kind of an astounding one, given that the slating it got, they're going to make a sequel to Roadhouse, like the Jake Gyllenhaal one.
Yeah. So it got a slating, but Prime Video are saying it did really well. It's one of their best movies out there that, you know, there were all these minutes watched. What they are not saying is, yes, all these people tuned in, but did they stay?
Yeah.
Did they watch the whole thing? They're just saying, and look, everyone probably would have tuned in, but I have to say this was one of the worst films that I've seen this year. Maybe what I'm thinking here is maybe, and again, we don't know what's going to happen. We know that Jake will be back, but I'm hoping that maybe this is the film that they should have made the first time around. Maybe this is their go to fix their mistakes.
This is their Godfather 2.
That is, I'm sorry, yizzer. Oh, yizzer, killing me. Like,
go
right,
on.
Right. So, to begin with, Conor McGregor couldn't act his way out of a paper bag. That's to begin with.
In fact, that's the only, I didn't watch it, but I was only slightly intrigued just to see how bad that was.
Oh, no, it's a train wreck.
It's not worth, you know, when it's so bad it's good? It's not that. You're not even doing that much.
It's not bad. Yeah, it's terrible. But, like, it's ridiculous because, like, you've actually touched on something there. Yes, 100,000 million people watched it for 5,000
million hours. They're saying 8 million.
Yeah, 8 million hours. How many of them actually enjoyed
million.
It?
Oh, 50 million,
50
sorry.
50 million, yeah, over its first two weekends.
How many of them enjoyed it?
They're not saying that.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's the problem. Yeah. They're not saying that, and they're not saying how many people actually even stuck around. Because this is the thing. You will be registered. As soon as you click in, that's a register, right? But we need more than that. Like, if I was an advertiser, I'd want to go, okay, but what if my product, because it's all about product placement, what if my product appears at minute 79? Is anybody going to be around for that?
Yeah. And even on top of that as well is, but there's also the fact of, you know, we have to take Amazon's word with this, you know, that sort of way. Like, if it gets released into a cinema, there's a box office that it goes through Unicom, it goes through Comscore, it goes through all these different things, and there's actually a verified figure at the end of it. And even with, you know, like TV, you had the Nielsen ratings, radio, you have the JLNR. So, like, there is a sort of, you know, there is some sort
there's
of
some metric.
There's some sort of independent metric. But when it comes to streaming and, like, you know, Netflix, Amazon Prime, Disney Plus, all we have to take for it is Disney Plus saying, yep, 500 million people watch this. And we're like, what are you basing that on? How do we know that they did that? Well, we've checked it and our figures say it is. And considering that, like, Facebook have been wrapped over the knuckles in the past for basically judging up all their viewing figures from Facebook Watch, and YouTube have done the same as well. There's just, I mean, these figures, they are literally just pulling them out of thin air. Like, so, maybe people did watch 50 million minutes of Roadhouse, but Jesus, I mean, how many people enjoyed it? Like, that's the thing I go back to.
Yeah. Maybe they just don't care because that doesn't really matter.
No. I think it's all kind of, there's so much of it now, it just all seems so sort of like airy fairy, has no kind of basis in reality anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of even playing into stuff like, you know, what's happening in Cannes at the minute with Francis Ford Coppola's film Megalopolis. Like, I'm reading all the reviews for it. It's nuts.
That is terrible?
Yeah. It's so strange. It's so odd. Like, it's Francis Ford Coppola. Like, it's an apocalypse now. And this is a man who literally sold off parts of his wine empire to pay for this
$120 million is what he spent.
Of his own money! Of his own money!
Can you imagine having that much money to just go, here we go?
Yeah. But like,
yeah, well, it shows you age doesn't bring wisdom.
No, but then, like, Peter Bradshaw is, like, giving it 2 stars and saying it's terrible. And then I've heard other people say, like, it's basically, like, The Room. Like, Tommy Wiseau's The Room.
Oh, God.
That's how bad. I've been on my phone, like, out there when I was out waiting, reading the reviews of it. It's insane. I can't believe it. So it's just up is down, black is white. I don't know.
But can we have a nice moment from the can where they're getting like these 10-minute standing ovations and they panned.
But don't
the,
you have to yeah, no. standard oh,
yeah,
now?
Yeah, yeah. I'd find that really awkward. But they panned over to Adam Driver and they were just on him. And it was really lovely. You can see it online. He grabs the camera
and shoves it
to Francis.
Okay.
So that was nice, wasn't it?
Just don't associate me with this film.
Yeah, it's all him. Like, push it away. It's all him. Blame him.
Adam Sanders, the highest paid actor in the world, says, won't take us true. He signed to Netflix. Netflix has their own global data. What are 30-somethings watching more than anything? Adam Sandler. You can be as sniffy as much as you want about this, but Netflix are giving people what they want. Someone else says Adam Sandler should make a movie called Unhappy Pillmore about a morose golfer with an addiction to Valium. It would win Cannes.
Well, to be fair, like, he did Funny People, and that was pretty much exactly what that guy, or whoever it was, yeah, it was probably a man, probably made that joke. And for that person saying they were being sniffy about it, not in the slightest.
No, it's Roadhouse are being sniffy about it.
Yeah. And I will take various dumps all over Roadhouse.
Yeah.
No problem.
There was somebody's texting to say Roadhouse was grand. Mind you, I had about 6 cans in me and a concussion. So maybe that reflects their audience. Which movie would you like to talk about first?
If.
We'll talk about If coming up after this.
What happened?
Well, she was putting that creepy doll to sleep.
Yeah.
She stopped. She looked up. She definitely felt something. So I slowly walked over to her. And as I got close,
What are you doing? No. Don't do this. Hey, don't do this, okay? Blue. Hey. I swear to God, I will never speak to you again as well. Don't do this, please. Do not. Please.
Okay, that's If. Just from an aural point of view, that was a slightly annoying clip. Imaginary friends, it's a nice, cuddly, warm, good-feeling idea.
That's really what this film is. It's just a very warm film. Like, you can tell that John Krasinski is really trying to kind of tug at the heartstrings. Probably a little bit too hard in places as well. Like, I mean, the whole sort of the animating kind of point of this is that John Krasinski's character is in New York to get surgery done on his heart, and previously his wife has died. And we find then that the child, Casey Fleming, is essentially kind of hardened herself up a little bit. She's toughened up a little bit. You know, she doesn't play with her toys anymore. She doesn't draw anymore. She doesn't use her imagination. But when she goes to live with her granny, who's played by Fiona Shaw, she slowly starts to kind of come out of her shell a little bit when she starts to see the imaginary friends around the building and stuff like that. I mean, you know, you watch this and you definitely do get the sense that John Krasinski is trying to kind of emulate Steven Spielberg more so than Pixar and Disney, because it feels very kind of like, you know, Hook or E.T. and that idea of sort of like childhood innocence and all the rest of it and sentimentality, but coming from a very humanist perspective. And even in terms of like how it looks as well, like he got the cinematographer that Spielberg uses, a guy called Janos Kaminski. So when you're watching it, like, it does really feel like it's kind of sort of a minor Spielberg film from the 80s or 90s, you know. And obviously as well, it's referencing Harvey as well, the James Stewart film. Like, there's one scene in it when Casey Fleming's character is like watching Harvey at home alone.
So
they really do kind of lean into it. What I would say about it is that compared to something like what Spielberg has done, it doesn't feel as kind of tonally coherent. There are certain parts of it where it's very kind of slapstick. You know, Ryan Reynolds' character is full on charm offensive. He's tripping over people and he's just really kind of, you know, yucking it up. And then there are other scenes where, you know, you would be in floods of tears if you were made of stone from watching it. Like, because when the imaginary friends reunite with the adults that they have now become, you can see the adults still have the kind of the inner child that's all nervous inside. But then when the imaginary friend comes and hugs them from behind and they can't see it, it just lights up the screen. And, you know, you can't help but kind of get sucked up into it. It's good. It's enjoyable. I think if you had kids and you went to see it with them, they'd get something out of it. You'd probably get more out of it than they would, I think. Would that be fair?
I saw it with the whole family. My 8-year-old, I loved watching his face. He had a goofy smile on his face. He got emotional. And I asked him for a review at the end. And he was like, it makes you feel like anything is possible.
Wow.
And I went, oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah. That's a terrible message to give children, because it's just not true.
Life will grind it out of them eventually, like, you know.
Okay. But yeah, but at the same time, I sense I'm kind of reluctant to say, you know. It wanted you to feel very emotional on the way out, but you didn't quite manage
it. Well, no, I mean, I'm dead on the inside anyway. But like, but in the sense of like, it's very much I always find with sentimental films like this that there is an element of a manipulation at kind of a,
yeah,
that they're trying to, it's like, isn't this so sad? The mother died. Oh no, the father's in the hospital. He might die as well. And you're kind of watching, you're like, okay, I know what you're trying to elicit from me and everything. But at the same time, it's like, you're trying so hard. It's almost kind of like, it's, you know, like there was a film a while back, All of Us Strangers, if you remember, yeah, Andrew Scott, yeah, and Paul Mescal. I felt it was similar as well in that, like, it's trying so hard to make you cry. It's trying so hard to get you to that place that you'll either just be pulled in by it or it will just push you back, you know, that kind of way.
Yeah.
And I feel like at times If had that as well. It just felt so sentimental that you're like, I'm almost, my teeth are rotting out of my head watching this. You know, like,
why do they always kill the mum? Like, even my 8-year-old
friend. Yeah, it's always the mother. Yeah.
He turned around to me and went, oh, there you go again, mum. They killed you off again. I was like, oh my gosh, always. Can we have something that brings us to that place without having to necessarily kill the mum?
Because I suppose if it's the father left by himself, there's more of a sense of struggle. He has to figure out where the washing machine is. You know, how do you turn it on? What is this strange black stuff on the floor? Oh my God, yeah, you can get rid of that. Who knew?
That's it, like 3 men and a baby. Like, that's literally what that was, yeah.
Yeah. Crikey. So Nicola Coughlan, I already did a spoiler. Bridgerton got the wear last night. So she's going to get her kit off later on.
Yes. So I love this. She's actually come out and said, do you know what? All the body shamers can just be off, go off with themselves, because I asked to be fully naked and I felt empowered. And I was like, do you know what? I look fabulous. And when I'm 80, I'm going to look back at myself and go, how fabulous do I look? And I am loving, it has to be said, I'm loving her in Bridgerton. Did you watch all 4 episodes?
Oh, no, I watched 10 minutes of it. She just happened to be kissing someone in the episode I saw. That's all.
I binged all 4. Really, really good.
Yeah. And this is kind of, like, there's a plot line where she's kind of,
so things are going to get,
she's looking for someone kind of thing.
You really don't watch Bridgerton.
No,
Bridgerton, and they're going to have they are having a will they won't they thing for the last 3 seasons.
All right, okay, sorry. Yes, I did not know that.
And their name is Pollen. Their couple name is Pollen. So it's Pollen season right now. And not the pollen in the sky. But so will she not get with Colin? Colin? Yes.
Yeah, Colin, yeah.
And so obviously the spoiler is in that when she tells you she gets naked and the two of them.
Well, she mightn't get naked with him. Might be somebody else completely.
Anyway, they get. It's going to get steamy. So if you are looking at watching Bridgerton, though, you can watch it with others, like with people that you're usually embarrassed to watch sex scenes with, maybe the first and second episode. After that, do not be watching it with people that make you feel uncomfortable.
Okay, but I thought that was basically their it was just like historical bonking, really. That's what Bridgerton is all about.
First season was, second season not so much. Part one, season 3. First half, not so much. Part 2, season 3, I think they're going
helpful. You're filled.
But who's keeping score? Yeah. I'm delighted to say Dean McGuinness has finally arrived. Afternoon, Dean.
How are you doing?
Sorry for your trauma out there.
Yeah.
The beers we're talking about today are very much aimed at smashing the patriarchy.
Yeah, absolutely. Historically, you would have had an awful lot more women involved in brewing. And for some reason, I think particularly since the Industrial Revolution, it has become a kind of a man-centric thing for no kind of real justifiable reason. Now,
then we live in a patriarchy. Well, that would be a pretty obvious one.
So what we're tasting today, there are about 33 Abbey beers in Belgium. This is the only one that comes from a monastery of Benedictine sisters.
Okay.
So it's, as we would know, as a convent.
Yeah, okay. And this is the one that's in front of us now?
Both of them are from the Maredres Abbey, and the first one that we're tasting is Maredret Triplus.
Okay.
So it is a triple, very fruity, very sweet, lovely floral aromas in it. Now, the history of the monastery is that the sisters in the monastery come from a tradition where they used plants for curing ailments and dealing with medical issues. So both of these beers are what would have been called an ale historically. They still are called ales historically, but that's for two different reasons. So the distinction used to be that the difference between ale and beer was brewed with hops and ale was brewed with spices and herbs.
Mm.
And now ale is brewed with ale yeast and lager is brewed with lager yeast. These beers are brewed with ale yeast and then brewed with herbs and spices as well.
Oh, crikey. But the terms are kind of increasingly getting meaningless.
Yeah, with that one, the reason for the change in the terminology is that it wasn't really possible for them to distinguish between ales and lagers up until about 150 years ago, because they didn't know the yeast existed. Mm. They knew that there was something. It was called God is Good by some people. you had a brewer's stick, and they knew that if they stirred the unfermented beer with the stick, that something magical would happen and the beer would ferment into beer. And what it was there was yeast growing on the stick. Mm. So they transferred the yeast in. They knew if they kept a bit of the last batch of beer and used it to start up the next batch of beer, just the same way as you do with the starter culture with soda bread, that worked. But they didn't know
what was causing
it was the thing. So the distinction now is based on yeast, and what you have is the ale yeast likes to work at a warm temperature, and when it works at a warm temperature, it develops fruity flavors and spicy flavors. Lager yeasts like to work at a cooler temperature, and they tend to have a kind of a cleaner flavor, so you tend to get less flavor from the yeast. But yeah, no, absolutely beautiful beer. Sweeter than...
Yes, it is. Yeah, distinctively
beers.
Sweet. It's, yes. Yeah,
and kind of candied apricot flavor. Mm. And there's a Belgian candy sugar flavor, marshmallow. There's clove, nutmeg, cinnamon, lots and lots of different flavors in it, but absolutely beautiful.
And this is where you're telling me it's 15 ABV or something
no,
like that.
It's no, it's quite a respectable 8% ABV. It's only kind of double the strength of normal beers in Ireland. And it is quite freaky how much it camouflages that strength.
It does, absolutely, because it doesn't. Yeah, that's what's setting off alarm bells, the stuff you usually bring in here. Right, OK, we do have to take a break. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. After the break, more Movies and Booze. Serena, Brian and Dean are still with us, and this actually sounds interesting to me, Serena. It's a documentary called Bratz. I hope it's not about the dolls, but about the actual Brat Pack.
I cannot wait. If you were a child of the 80s, early 90s, you'll know all about the Brat Pack. That consisted of people who are now superstars, really. You've got Rob Lowe, Tom Cruise, Emilio Estevez, John Cryer, Leah Thompson. Okay, some of them you may not know.
Yeah, Leah Thompson. Not all of them.
Everyone knows Leah Thompson.
Yeah.
Ali Sheedy. A lot of these people were actually part of 1980s. Why can't I think of the Breakfast Club producers?
John Hughes.
John Hughes.
St. Elmo's Fire as well.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, because I wouldn't have put Tom Cruise in the Brat Pack. Yeah, he'd be kind of separate to that.
No, because he was part of The Outsiders.
Okay.
That was one of his first movies. Okay. And when he did The Outsiders, they were all in, Ralph Macchio as well, they were all in The Outsiders, and they all went on to, they were like 18, 19 getting their first roles. So they were out there doing their partying and stuff. And so Andrew McCarthy, who was also part of the Brat Pack, he did Pretty in Pink and St. Elmo's Fire, but I remember him for Mannequin. Do you remember Mannequin?
Yeah.
And was Kim Cattrall, yeah.
And
yeah,
he was also in Weekend at Bernie's.
Yep, that's right. Yeah.
So he's gone back to chat to some of the people. Tom Cruise isn't involved.
But yeah.
Not surprising.
No. Mm. Rob Lowe is, Ali Sheedy, Emilio Estevez, John Cryer, who was from 2 and a Half Men. Mm. And they're looking back at their time in the Brat Pack. And the thing that I find really interesting as well is that he's going to talk to the guy, the journalist, who actually branded them the Brat Pack as well. So I think this could be really interesting, especially if you grew up in that era, you followed even if you didn't, what was it like to be a teen star in the 80s as opposed to today?
Yeah,
I think that'd be really interesting. And these documentaries usually really work now because now there is so much footage. So it's really, I think the reason why I like the Bon Jovi one, and I think this might be a bit like that, is because you were seeing someone who's realised his dreams talking to that 20-year-old who's chasing his dreams.
Yeah. Michael J. Fox documentary was like that as well.
That was the best one.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
I don't think any other documentary will live up to that one because of the way that he creatively used his film clips and stuff. But I cannot wait. They're saying that this is coming out in the US on Hulu on the 13th of June, but hopefully Disney Plus will pick that up in the summer. And that, I think those numbers will tell us that did really well.
Yes, okay, I mean, and it is still trading on that nostalgia, but at least there's a bit of creativity to the idea. Right, so we might as well move on to our second movie of the day. It is Ransom 79. Here's a clip.
I'm working with Charlie Bird on a case from 1979. Dear Minister.
There was the ransom demand for £5 million.
If you do this, we shall not introduce to this country one of the most deadly diseases that could afflict any country.
Foot and mouth would have been devastating.
It was always the position of governments that ransoms would not be paid.
I mingled with well-known criminals. I don't want to go any further, Charlie.
There was mayhem in the country. You would remember it. You were there.
Other than you approaching me, I would never have revealed this story.
His whole life he worked as a journalist. He forgets about M&D when he is doing work and he's getting stuck into it.
I have a terminal illness, but I still have my journalistic nose for a good story.
Right, that's Ransom 17. Mm. Over what period of time was this shot, Brian?
I think it was like shot basically in his like last 6 months to the year.
Crikey.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, there are moments in this film where he basically has to stop the film and because he's having like a swallowing fit. Like, there's one scene in it where he's interviewing this former IRA commander in a pub. And the IRA guy is basically, or former IRA guy is basically saying that, you know, yes, the IRA at that time were involved in extortion plots and all the rest of it. And then you see Charlie Bird like moving his hand like this to cut the filming. And he basically has to stand up and try kind of force himself to swallow. But then he goes straight back. He sits back down and continues on the interview. Like, so it I would imagine this was like his last like 6 months to the year. But I mean, he addresses it full on and in a very matter of fact way. I mean, there's one part in it early on in the film when he's talking to Colm Quinn, who you heard there in the thing, where he says, I'm probably not going to see the end of this. You need to start planning for my death. You need to start planning to finish this investigation without me. And that's really what this was. I mean, it was an investigation, but it was very much Charlie Bird's last investigation and very much a story that he knew that he was not going, he would probably not see the end result of, you know? Yeah. And I think that's the thing. Like, he's not looking for sympathy. It's not the sort of like, oh, how great am I? When the motor neuron disease comes into it, it's basically, it's almost sort of like, it's standing in the way of him getting there, you know, that kind of way. And when you're watching the film as well, like, I mean, there are so many different strands in it that it could have easily gotten caught up in. Like, for example, Charlie Bird was a socialist in the early 70s. Like, he was a member of the Young Socialist Movement. Mm. And one of the members of the Young Socialists was eventually tied to this group called Sarah Eyre. And they were kind of tangentially involved in this extortion plot. There's another whole thing about, like, how, you know, basically Ireland in the 70s was just like this. It just seems so lawless. Like, I mean, there was like this whole outlaw underground of these subversive groups that were working, and like there was constant like bank raids, extortion plots going on in Ireland this time. They could have easily spent time doing this. Yet Colm Quinn and Charlie Bird's sort of journalistic integrity and that determination and that, I think, discipline keeps it solely on this one story. Like, they've got to get to the end of this. And they really, really do drill down to it. Like, I mean, it's so forensic. Like, they bring in like a clinical psychiatrist to read the ransom notes and determine basically that the person who wrote this was of, you know, college education, was probably an educated person. Then they bring in, like, you know, a person from the from UCD, from veterinary medicine, and they basically talk about how, okay, if this extortion group was real, how would they do it? Well, they'd use pigs. That's the easiest way to spread foot and mouth disease, and it'd be very easily introduced. Like, all you have to do is just introduce a small sample into a herd of pigs, and then it will spread like wildfire. And then they bring in Bertie Ahern, and Bertie Ahern at the time was, you know, I think he was like a private secretary or something like that. And he talks about the fact that, you know, this would have been kept absolutely under lock and key. There would have been no notice about this in any papers at all. And then they literally wheel out the agricultural minister of the time, Ray McSherry, Mac the Knife.
Yeah.
And he's talking about, and he's all like, yeah, I knew exactly all about this. I remember this and blah, blah, blah. And we kept this under lock and key. So when you're watching this, you actually see Charlie Bird. At one point, he goes, this is unbelievable. I never knew this happened.
And the ransom demand was that,
real.
Was, yeah, you give us £5 million or we'll introduce foot and mouth into the country.
That was literally it. They would said, if you don't, the letter is like, it's all typed out. And the group basically say that we've spent lots of money. We have research on this. We are going to do this if you do not give us £5 million. And then they give them like really detailed instructions about how much the money is supposed to be dispersed. There's like a literally, it's like almost like a Frederick Forsyth, Jack Higgins political thriller where it's literally minute to minute. The car must arrive in Nace at 15:35. By 15:35, it will drop. They will have fuel there for them. You then need to drive to Ballymore Eustace. Then you need to drive to Wexford. And it's literally, they follow it from piece to piece. And again, that's I think that's like from Charlie Bird's journalism, that, you know, he's so forensic about it. He was so sharp that he knew exactly that he had to get this down to the minute details of it, you know?
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
That's an extraordinary story.
It's an extraordinary story. And again, I knew nothing about it. And I have to admit, I have a real yen for these kind of political thrillers in the 70s and 80s, like, you know, Bader-Meinhof complex. You know, the RAF, like the Red Army faction in Germany, all these like left-wing groups that were on the make around that time, and how kind of desperate it was, and how it was just really this battle for supremacy, and just how down and dirty it got, you know?
Yeah. Now, and I certainly don't want to give away any spoilers on this, but it was a credible threat, was it?
Oh, it was real. Oh, yeah, no, yeah. It was a credible threat.
It wasn't
threat.
Just some spoof.
No,
Trinity
not at
students.
All. Like, and this is the whole thing of it, is that they basically identified two of the three people that were involved in it. The third person was this barrister who they, I presume, is still alive. But they were like, yeah, we're not going to name him. Like, no, we can't name him. We can't do that yet. But the other two people who were involved in it, they named them, and they literally play interviews from them, that there was this one guard detective, a guy called Tom Connolly, who it's almost kind of like, it reminded me in a weird kind of way of Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. He basically struck up this friendship with this IRA convicted criminal over 30 years. He went to visit him in Port Leash and stuff like that. And he was one of the guys that took him down. And guard detective Tom Connolly, he was interviewing this guy over the years, and this guy knew about this extortion plot because he was involved with those left-wing groups back then. And he was like, yeah, I remember this. I remember that. Yeah, that was a real thing. They had all the samples.
That's
they were going to do
it. Is this in cinemas?
It is in cinemas, yeah. It'll be in cinemas next week. You'll see it in kind of like select cinemas, so like the IFI. I'd imagine the Triskel down in Cork would have it. Palace and Galway will have it. Virgin Media are involved in it as well, so you'll probably see it on TV in maybe 2-3 months' time, but okay. I would recommend people watch it. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Our second beer.
Yes, we have Maradres Altus. Now, in Germany, there's a term called Altbier, and Alt refers to old. So again, it's this idea of there being a distinction between two different types of beer. This would be kind of under the heading of Altbier, and that would put it into the kind of general ale category. The alternative in Germany being lager, which would be the newer type of beer. Now, with this one, again, brewed with Rut, which is the herbs and spice blend. In the case of this, and I can't say the word juniper berries without thinking of a naked man jumping out of a hole with a big long beard. I don't know if you remember The Life of Brian. There was a guy who...
Oh, right, okay. I just thought that was like some random weekend you had.
So this is brewed with juniper berries, and I don't know why it triggers that memory every single time I mention the word juniper berries, but it does. And also clove. And they're using spelt as a grain in it. So the spelt is a really interesting flavour. It's kind of, it's similar to wheat. It's kind of native grain.
Yeah. It's for celiacs, though. My wife eats spelt bread, yeah.
Yeah, the spelt would be okay, but it is also brewed with malt barley, so you'd have it's gluten and proteins that are very, very similar to gluten that would trigger the same type of reaction that you would have with celiac disease. So amber beer, you get a kind of a caramelly flavour, flavour of juniper berries, and then there's a kind of a nutty hazelnut walnut flavour from the spelt. It's a little bit drier than the Triplus. The Triplus is quite luscious, but has a clean finish and cleanses off the palate. With this one, you get I've never eaten juniper berries. It's something I'll have to do sometime. I might have
to. And run around naked.
Keep your clothes on.
Yeah. Do it in the privacy of your own home.
But they taste not as a kind of a very juicy flavour. It's kind of a, you know, the type of berry that you'd eat that would be a little bit harder and, you know, wouldn't kind of explode in your mouth. So you've got that berry flavour, but a slightly drier, cleaner flavour. The nuttiness, the clove comes through as well. Now, with Belgian beer, you can sometimes get clove from the yeast. In this instance, it's clove actually put into it. So you're getting kind of quite a distinctive clove flavour. But again, yeah, very, very different from the Triplus, but another beautiful beer.
Yeah, and is, again, women brew this?
With Abbey beers, what you have is you have a relationship between the breweries. So this is brewed in Waterloo, and then they have a relationship with the Abbeys. So So there's a connection to the Abbey and there's a contribution to the Abbey.
Right, okay.
So like, similarly with Chimay and with La Trappe and Trappist breweries, there would be a direct connection and there would be input. So for example, Chimay can only brew a new beer if the monks agree to it. They, you know, they have to approve everything that happens.
And the ABV on this, because again, that doesn't taste strong at all.
It's a respectable 6.8%.
Okay, that's just like water then, really.
It's something you'd have in your cornflakes.
Yeah, it would. Indeed, you would. Nicolas Cage's Spider-Man. I know it's animated, but I would... Is it not?
No, it is. Yeah, no, it's going to be live action.
Yeah, no, this is real, isn't it?
Yeah, this is real.
You know, brilliant. Nicolas Cage running around the place, a big gut on him, shouting at people. Yeah, fantastic.
I can't wait. No, this is going to be great.
I think you should take this because he's playing, and again, this was at the upfronts for Prime Video. He plays an aging and down on his luck private investigator. This is where I'm interested. It's in 1930s New York. So it's really, I'd say it's going to be eccentric, like Nicolas Cage. No one better to play someone like this. Why are you so excited?
Okay, so it's called Spider-Man Noir.
Yeah.
So, I will explain. If anyone's seen Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, essentially what's going on in it is that there are different versions of Spider-Man, and one of the versions of it is Spider-Man Noir. So it's basically Spider-Man, but in a noir detective story. So you're think Raymond Chandler, think, you know, kind of down and dirty. He's got the fedora hat and he's, you know, like monologuing to himself and stuff like that. They're doing a TV series out of it. It's going to be live action. It's going to be Nicolas Cage with the fedora and the big ridiculous black kind of, you know, trench coat and everything like that, running around trying to solve a story. I cannot wait.
But is he Spider-Man?
Yeah, he's Spider-Man, but he's Spider-Man Noir. He's like a different iteration of it, but a 1930s detective-inspired version of Spider-Man. You're rolling your eyes.
Rolling my eyes. No. I would look forward to
this. This is going to be class. Yeah. I can't wait for this. This is going to be brilliant.
Okay. When's this going to come out?
It hasn't started shooting yet. So it was just mentioned at the upfronts. Again, they're trying to get their money. So I'd say, but Brian will be giving it all of its views.
I would say like 2025, 2026.
Yeah.
Calling it now, it's going to be brilliant, nailing my colours to the cross. Come back to me 2 years' time. I'm going to be raving about this.
Okay.
Can't wait.
You do know we record all these shows.
Yeah. Brian,
Serena and Dean, thank you all very much.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.
American Log Homes and Cabins is assisting a developer in liquidating several of our kits that have deposits on them for only the balance owed. Most of these will save you more than half of the original cost. An example, our Augusta model, normally $42,450, is being sold for $16,500. Our Biloxi model, normally $36,825, is being sold for $14,500. This includes delivery, excluding California, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, Idaho, Alaska, and Hawaii. But we will pay partial shipping to those states. These kits have not been manufactured, and there's no time limit on delivery. This is a log home kit that includes complete blueprints from foundation details to roof, stack sheets, and a construction manual. Any do-it-yourselfer or builder can erect the logs. Kits do not include any part of roof, windows, or doors. Please call 704-602-3035 for availability. You can also visit our website at www.americanloghomesandcabins.com.